This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode features discussion of torture, violence, death, and abuse that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. On a chilly day in November 1996, thousands of prisoners gathered before wooden gallows in a wheat field in North Korea. Uniformed guards pushed through the crowd, dragging a thin, weary prisoner, 14-year-old Shin Dong-hyuk. He was going to watch this from the front row, whether he wanted to or not.
He watched as two convicts were led toward the gallows, a skeletal young man, barely strong enough to walk, and a middle-aged woman, badly swollen from beatings. As they drew closer, Shin recognized them. His mother and his older brother. A soldier read the indictment. Shin barely heard any of it, except the last sentence. Chang Hye-kong and Shin Ha-kun, enemies of the people, are sentenced to death.
As the guards tied the noose around Shin's mother's neck, she stared right at him, trying to meet his eye. He looked away.
Shin didn't feel any sorrow. He thought his mother deserved to die. In fact, he was the one who'd turned them in. They'd broken the labor camp's first law: do not try to escape. Anyone caught escaping will be shot immediately.
Welcome to Survival on the Parcast Network. I'm your host, Irma Blanco.
And I'm Tim Johnson. Every Monday, we'll take you inside incredible true stories of life or death situations. This is our first of two episodes on Shin Dong-hyuk, the only person to ever escape from North Korea's K-Chun internment camp.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
What would you do to stay alive? Would you cut off your own arm, drink your own urine, cannibalize your own family? When the stakes are life and death, you might be surprised at the lengths you'd go to save yourself.
Human beings can withstand an incredible amount of physical and emotional trauma without breaking. But even after making it to safety, those experiences can leave scars that take a lifetime to heal, if they ever heal at all.
Each week, we'll look through the eyes of some of the world's most resilient survivors as their self-preservation instincts are pushed to the limit.
As Irma walks us through the story, I'll delve deeper into the strategies they use to survive. We'll also look at the psychological effects of living through a traumatic event, months, years, or decades down the road.
Now, let's turn back to the story of North Korean defector Shin Dong-hyuk.
There are 10 rules at North Korea's K-Chun internment camp. Number 1, do not try to escape. Anyone caught escaping will be shot immediately.
Number 2. Anyone who fails to secure permission from a guard for a meeting of more than two prisoners will be shot immediately.
Number 3. Anyone found stealing will be shot immediately.
Number 4. Anyone who fails to demonstrate total compliance with the guard's instructions will be shot immediately.
Number 5. Anyone who provides cover for or protects a fugitive will be shot immediately.
Number 6. Prisoners must watch each other and report any suspicious behavior.
Number 7. Prisoners who neglect their work quota or fail to complete it will be shot immediately.
Number 8. Should sexual physical contact occur without prior approval, the perpetrators will be shot immediately.
Number 9. Prisoners must genuinely repent of their errors. Anyone who does not acknowledge his sins and instead denies them or carries a deviant opinion of them will be shot immediately.
And lastly, number 10. Prisoners who violate the laws and regulations of the camp will be shot immediately. All prisoners must truly consider the guards as their teachers and yield themselves through toil and discipline to washing away their past errors.
According to a 2014 UN Commission of Inquiry, there are an estimated 120,000 people currently imprisoned in North Korea's internment camps. At Kaechun Internment Camp, commonly known as Camp 14, political prisoners, their children, and their children's children are worked to death with no possibility of release. Camp 14 was opened in 1959, 6 years after the end of the Korean War, and it's still open in 2019. According to a report by the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, the camp is around 30 miles long and 19 miles wide, and surrounded by steep mountains, a 10-foot high-voltage fence, and soldiers armed with automatic weapons. Only one person has ever escaped, Shin Dong-hyuk. He was born in Camp 14 in either 1980 or 1982. Shin's entire family was sentenced to a lifetime of hard labor because his uncle had defected to South Korea years before he was even born. In the midst of food shortages, torture, abuse, and routine executions, every day in Camp 14 was a struggle to survive.
In the summer of 2004, 8 years after his mother and brother's execution, Shin Dong-hyuk hunched over a cast iron sewing machine in a factory repair room. It was nearly midnight. His shift should have been over already, but the team hadn't met their quota, so they all had to stay an extra 2 hours. The superintendent called it bitter humiliation work. Shin's fingers ached. A few years ago, the guards had punished him by prying his fingernails off one by one and smashing his middle finger so hard it was completely torn off at the joint. And then, almost to taunt him, they'd assigned him to a work detail repairing sewing machines, maneuvering tiny metal gears by hand for 14 or more hours a day.
At least he was still young. Either 21 or 23, he wasn't sure. By age 40, most prisoners are hunched and brittle from malnutrition. By 50, they're usually dead.
Finally, the clock struck 12. Shin and the other three repairmen headed back to their dormitory in the next building over. Shin's stomach growled as he lay down on the patch of floor he called a bed. He hadn't eaten since dinner in the early evening, which was just a small bowl of lukewarm cabbage soup. Careful not to be overheard, one of the other repairmen whispered an idea. There was a vegetable garden behind the factory, and there was no moon that night. If they were quiet, they could probably pull off a heist without getting caught.
Of course, they'd be breaking rule number 3, which banned stealing at the risk of execution. Shin had memorized the camp's 10 laws as a child. He'd lived in the labor camp since birth and this was the only sense of right and wrong he'd ever learned. Living is good. Dying is bad. For the most part, living meant following the rules.
But in reality, the executions were only enforced sporadically. A few prisoners were executed on a regular basis as an example to the others. But if they killed every person who broke a minor rule, the government would lose its entire workforce of slave laborers. Chances were, if they were caught stealing, they'd only be punished with a beating.
Starvation was a much more pressing threat than execution. Shin was so gaunt, pain radiated through his bones when he lied down on the floor to sleep. His muscles ached from the long days of hauling cast iron sewing machines up the stairs on his back. And he was so hungry, it felt like his stomach was eating itself.
Even if they were caught and executed, a gunshot to the head is less painful than a slow death from starvation. Shin and his three friends all agreed it was a risk worth taking. The young men snuck out of the dormitory and crept along the edge of the building. It was pitch dark and starting to rain. The drizzle disguised the sound of their movements as they stumbled through the maze of buildings. At any turn, they might run headfirst into a guard, or, just as bad, another prisoner who might snitch on them. But as Shin's eyes adjusted to the darkness, he saw it up ahead. The garden. They filled their arms with anything they could carry. Cucumbers, radishes, eggplants, delicacies the prisoners were never allowed to eat. When they got back to their room, they sat on the floor and feasted. For the first time in a long time, Shin went to sleep with a full belly.
As soon as they got to the factory the next morning, Shin and his three accomplices were called into the superintendent's office. The superintendent was the only military guard at the factory. The rest of the foremen and managers were prisoners who'd been promoted for their obedience and their physical imposingness. They weren't any kinder than the soldiers. In fact, they were even more brutal. But the superintendent was the only one who was armed, and the only one with the authority to dole out serious punishment.
Shin and his friends lined up before the desk, frozen with fear. Shin immediately knew which one of them had snitched. Kang Man Bok. Shin could tell just from the look on his face. Sure enough, the superintendent told Kang to go back to work. He left quietly, avoiding Shin's eyes. Then the superintendent turned to the other three. He whacked them each on the head with the club a few times, told them their food rations would be cut in half for the next 2 weeks, and sent them back to the factory.
Shin understood what Kang had done. After all, he was a snitch too. But he didn't know how to forgive him. As Shin later put it, in their world, to ask for forgiveness was only to beg not to be punished.
A couple months later, in October 2004, Shin was called back to the superintendent's office. This time, he hadn't done anything wrong, not personally, but he still had to make up for his mother and brother's offense 8 years ago.
Shin was the one who'd reported his mother and brother's escape plan to the guards. He'd done exactly what he was supposed to do, but it didn't win him any favors. Instead, he had to do more penance to prove he wasn't a traitor like the rest of his family.
There was a new prisoner arriving at the factory, a man named Park Young-chul. He was a very important man with close ties to the North Korean government. He'd lived in the Soviet Union and East Germany, and, according to the superintendent, he hadn't confessed the full extent of his crimes. Shin's job was to train Park in the art of sewing machine maintenance. His second, unofficial task was to report back on anything interesting Park had to say about his past.
Shin immediately agreed. He was already expected to inform on the other prisoners. And if he found out anything scandalous, he might even be rewarded with extra food rations.
Park Young-chul arrived at the factory the next morning. He was a short, stocky man of about 50 years of age, with a head of snowy white hair. He was dignified without being arrogant. When Shin introduced himself, Park even replied using the honorific.
In Korean, honorific verb endings signify that the person being spoken to is superior to the person speaking, similar to ending a sentence with sir or ma'am. Park used it as a sign of respect, since Shin was technically the teacher. But Park was twice his age and clearly higher in the social hierarchy. Shin found it a little embarrassing.
Shin led Park around the floor, explaining the ins and outs of the job. There were 1,000 or 2,000 seamstresses at the factory. Each repairman was responsible for about 50 of them.
As Shin spoke, Park paid close attention, nodding along politely. Almost too politely. By the tail end of a 14-hour shift, the honorific usage was no longer awkward, it was just irritating.
The saving grace was that Park didn't speak much at all. After 4 weeks, Shin hadn't learned anything useful. His dream of extra food was slipping away. And then, one quiet day, when they were alone in the repair room, Park asked Shin, "Where is your home, sir?"
Shin was caught off guard. It was the first personal question Park had ever asked him. All he could say was, "My home is here."
Park replied, without being asked, "I'm from Pyongyang, sir."
Shin's patience finally snapped. He said, "I'm younger than you. Please drop the honorific with me."
Park said, "I will." They went back to working in silence. After a moment, Shin turned back to Park and asked, "Where's Pyongyang?"
Park was intrigued. Everyone in North Korea knew about the capital city, except, apparently, the ones who'd spent their entire lives in labor camps.
Park explained that Pyongyang was where all the government officials lived. He'd lived there too, as the head of an elite Taekwondo gym. Park rested his hand on a sewing machine and said, quote, "With this hand, I shook Kim Jong-il's hand."
That meant little to Shin. He was vaguely aware of the dear leader, Kim Jong-il, but the prisoners at Camp 14 weren't bombarded with the usual propaganda. There was no point in brainwashing them. They'd never be leaving the camp alive anyway.
From then on, Park became the teacher. He taught Shin that different countries have different forms of money. Then he taught Shin what money was. He explained what cell phones were, how gravity worked, why South Korea had it better than the North.
Shin didn't really care about any of this. He barely understood where South Korea was, much less how their economy worked. What interested him were the stories about food. Park had lived all over the world, and he regaled Shin with tales of stir-fried pork in China, sausage in Germany, chicken Kiev in Russia.
The only meat Shin ever ate was from rats he caught around the factory, ripped open and devoured raw.
Park tried to teach Shin about proper cooking procedures, too. He wouldn't let him eat the rats until they found a furnace to roast them over.
But the more Shin heard about the food on the outside, the more unbearable his hunger felt. His growling stomach kept him up all night, while his mind swam with visions of all-you-can-eat buffets and warm bowls of rice. For the first time, he had something to dream about. One of those nights, Shin came to a decision. He wasn't going to snitch on Park.
If Shin told the superintendent everything he'd learned, he might be rewarded with an extra bowl of soup. But he would lose Park's stories, which were the only thing he had to look forward to. Without that seed of hope, there was no reason to survive.
When Shin was called back to the superintendent's office a few weeks later, he looked him right in the eye and said Park wasn't talking. The superintendent seemed to believe him. He sent Shin back to work and told him to keep pressing.
Every week, Shin reported back and told his supervisor the same thing. Park had nothing to say. It worked for a while. But by protecting his new friend, Shin may have sealed his own fate. It might have been his refusal to snitch on Park. Or maybe it was punishment for something one of his distant family members had done. It could have been for the time he was caught stealing from the garden, or the many times his shift didn't meet its production quota, or any other offense, real or imagined. But whatever he did, in December of 2004, Shin found out that his own execution would be happening in 2 months.
Coming up, we'll follow Shin's new survival strategy, escape.